It's been 75 years since President Roosevelt's executive order forced more than 100,000 Japanese Americans to live in internment camps. Rebecca Ozaki's grandparents were among them.
They were forced to burn everything they had that was Japanese. A lot of people, even though they knew Japanese growing up, stopped speaking Japanese completely and didn't want to teach their kids that.
Rebecca joins us to share stories she heard from her late grandfather and how she thinks it has particular resonance today. But first, how can farmers who have physical disabilities keep doing their jobs?
Our goal is to give farmers a hand up, not a handout, and help them be able to be as productive as they possibly can or want to be in light of their physical limitations.
We'll talk with the director of one program designed to help, and we meet an Illinois farmer who lost one of her legs in a farm accident in the 80s, but still found a way to continue farming. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Every year, hundreds of Illinois farmers are injured in accidents. Sometimes that leaves them with a physical disability, and many of them need help getting back to work and life on the farm. That's where the AgriAbility program comes in. It's actually a nationwide program that supports agricultural workers with disabilities by connecting them with equipment, training, and other services. In studio with me is Bob Aharon. He's the Illinois AgriAbility Program Director. He also works as a safety specialist with the University of Illinois Extension. It's one of the lead agencies for the program. Bob, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure for me to be here.
Bob, how often does it happen that farmers find themselves unable to do their work, maybe because of a sudden accident that they had?
Well, in Illinois, we have about a little over 5,000 accidents a year, of which about 200 to 300 are permanent injuries of some type, and others are more temporary injuries. It may be a few weeks or a couple months where they get through it. We estimate in Illinois about 2.5 to 3% of the over nearly 500,000 people who work on farms. This includes a farm operator, the employees, and family members. Suffer from some type of physical disability due to injuries or an age-related or an illness-related type of problem.
And so people reach out to you and they reach out to your program not just because of accidents, but as you said, also maybe for other health reasons, maybe sometimes related to, would that be something like aging? What kind of other resources can you help people
with? Well, we have an aging farm population. Like the average age of farmers is about 55 years of age. And so as we get older, we have problems, arthritis, heart conditions, diabetes, just a variety of things. And so our program is to try to help them continue farming as best they can in light of whatever their physical limitations may be. And we have access to thousands of different types of assistive technology, the technology to help identify what would work best for any given farm. And so our goal is to try to help farmers continue to farm and be as productive as they possibly can. Some cases that may mean making some significant changes on the farm, depending on the type of disability. But.
And when you say assistive technology, what kind of things are you talking about?
Oh, we're talking about things like lifts for tractors, combines, trucks, hand controls that maybe they don't have use of one foot or both feet. Maybe they have to use their feet. They don't have an arm or something that they can use readily. We also looking at situations of hand tools that can be make adaptations that will allow for certain types of disabilities to continue to use a hand tool, making walkways into buildings and things like that are alleyway type things that we can do and make changes to help them get access to their buildings. So it's just a variety of things, getting mobility like equipment, like a gaiter or something, so that they can't walk around very easily or do a lot of walking, so they could qualify to get a gaiter or something of that nature to help them get around their farm. I mean, those are the kind of things we help them with.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And now I know recently you all just got some funding from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Where does most of your funding come from?
Well, now most of the funding comes from a grant that we a competitive grant that we received a commitment for 4 years of funding, and we just started our second year of funding. We receive $180,000 a year to help run the program in the state of Illinois. We also have been getting about $30,000 a year in private contributions from various organizations in the state, like the Farm Bureau, Illinois Agricultural Association Foundation, First Farm Credit, just a variety of groups.
That's Bob Aharon. He's with the University of Illinois Extension. He's a safety specialist. We've been talking to him about the Illinois Agribility Program. I want to bring someone else into this conversation, someone who's taken part in the program, Brenda Bessie. She's on the line with us from Erie in northwestern Illinois. Brenda, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Brenda, you lost your leg in a farm accident. Was this back in 1981?
Correct.
And can you tell us what happened? What went through? What happened?
I was in a field where it had been hit earlier in its growing season by a pretty good sized windstorm. So the stalks in the cornfield were leaning to one direction rather than standing upright, and so the combine was having a hard time on the one direction. Picking the crop properly, and so there was a lot of on and off the equipment and untangling in front of the feeder house, and that's when we came in contact, and that's when my lower leg was taken off of me in about 2 minutes.
Wow. Brenda, how long had you been farming at that point?
Well, I was 23, and I was born and raised in a farm family, so, you know, I've been around machinery my whole life and operated equipment probably from the time I was about 8 or 9.
Mm-hmm. And so I can't imagine how tough that must have been for you physically and emotionally. Was it something that you just thought pretty soon after your accident, I'm going to keep doing what I've been doing, I want to stay on the farm?
Well, you know, a lot of things cross your mind after something like that. I was pretty much a high school and college athlete, and so that was the biggest shocker that I was going to have to adjust to life with, you know, some sort of prosthetic appliance. And agriculture has been in my blood for a long time and 3 and 4 generations back. So we've had some accidents in our family, and we've had some accidents within our community, so... Yeah, it's not like I was the very first one to ever come across some sort of travesty here.
Mm-hmm. And how did you find out about the Agribility program?
You know, I was just racking my brain here a while ago. I just can't remember exactly how I found out about the Agribility program, but I know that I found out about it right around 91, 92.
So about 10 years after your accident was when you found out about it then.
10 years after my accident. Mm-hmm. And I decided that I wanted to get involved with the program. So I did. I called down to the university and hooked up with Bob. And I was a community ambassador for a couple years, which meant I took care of my county and it helped if there was an accident within Whiteside County. And then... I don't know, it must have been around 94 or 5 maybe is when Bob decided to go ahead and give me some leadership in the northern half of the state as a field rep.
Right, so doing work with coordinating things. Bob, you know, as Brenda's telling us that she's talking about being a community ambassador, what kind of things does that entail? What kind of work was Brenda doing? Both, I imagine you have community ambassadors all across the state.
Right. We have about approximately 80 around the state, and they're basically our eyes and ears for the program. Focus is to try to promote the program locally because we have a very small budget and we have a few part-time staff, professional staff involved with it. So we can't have a very big impact by ourselves. We need to rely on volunteers to help us identify farm people who could benefit from the program and have the, you know, help. Also, they usually have a lot of credibility with the farmers in their community. They're known, and so they can help them link them to us so that we understand farmers are often very prideful people, and sometimes it's difficult for them to want to connect to a program like this to reach out for some help. But our motto we got from one of our other clients was that we're a program that gives a hand up, not a handout. We try to help them become more productive, be self-sufficient, and be able to provide for themselves and their families in light of their disabilities or improve on their ability to do that.
Brenda, was that something that was tough for you to ask for help? Was that something you found hard to do to reach out?
I my biggest thing was my mobility was a little bit of a problem as far as on rough terrain and in and around the cow barns. And I inquired about getting a little utility vehicle that could haul baby bottles and feed and shavings or whatever my needs or medicines or, you know, vet supplies, whatever. And we worked out an arrangement where the agribility program threw in some money and I paid for the rest of it. And we just got a John Deere Gator and that worked out. We still running that thing today.
Mm-hmm. So that was for you was the Gator, that cart to kind of get around the farm for you. That was the most important
right.
thing. How big is your farm, Brenda?
Well, there's kind of two separate entities. We farm 2,000 acres, and then we also run a cattle business on the side.
Wow. Okay. So that's a lot of area to get around. I mean, for
right.
you, and it's, you know, something that Bob said, Brenda, struck me, which is just, I mean, having community ambassadors, I think, is important because you want people who are in the community. I imagine when you're talking to folks, being someone who's, you know, grown up on a farm, family farm, and lived this yourself, do you feel like it's probably easier maybe for people to trust you because they feel like you understand the experience that they've gone through?
Well, farmers are, like Bob said, you know, they're just a pretty prideful people, and they're kind of not like the rest of the world where they're always wanting some sort of handout. So it was a lot easier for me to meet up with these families that have run into some sort of snag, whether it be, you know, arthritis or an amputation or a spinal cord injury or a chemical burn or any of those, anything that can happen, because not any of the two cases are the same, and each case is always sad and dreadful. I always want to remember the caregiver because it always seems like the caregiver really could use just about as much support as the injured party itself. So I always try and remember who's taking care of this person and throw them some support as much as
yeah,
I can.
Yeah, Brenda, that's a really important point. Bob, when you're thinking about that, you're thinking about farming families, so what happens when someone calls? What's the process like?
Well, if someone calls and they have a significant problem and requesting some help, we have a client service manager who typically named Dr. Chip Petrie, who will go out and meet with the family if they're okay with that, and we'll sit down and try to find out what their disability is, what their priority is, what the priorities are, what they would like to get done. We can't often do everything at once for lots of reasons, and so. We try to set the priorities that they have, and then we try to identify the kind of assistive technologies that would help them. There was a discussion about whether they need any financial help to purchase some of this assistive technology, and then if they do, we will help them see if they first qualify for financial assistance to buy the technology from Illinois Department of Rehab Services, and if they may not qualify for whatever reason, then we'll look at other sources. We have access to low and no-cost loans from some different sources. We have some money ourselves that we can't use any of our USDA money to help farmers with the cost of disabilities. That's not allowed, but we use some of the private funds we can help with farmers that we raise. And that's why we keep constantly trying to raise the private funds to help with the farmers who kind of fall through the cracks for other support, but we can help cost share like we did with Brenda, purchase something.
And your services are free.
Our services, no charge.
If anyone wants to come to you for the services that you offer as you're connecting folks, that there's no charge for that.
Right. We are free, and part of our job is connecting certain different services. We have three other major partners that work with us in this program.
For both of you, Bob, let's start with you, and Brenda, I'd love to have you weigh in after. Bob, you started this program here in Illinois back in the 90s. Brenda, around the time that you started getting involved as well. I imagine when you're talking about things like assistive technologies, the technology itself has really changed. Do you find that there's a lot of more help that's available now than maybe was 20 years ago?
Well, the technology's become more advanced, and we've found more tech things that will work better. Some of the stuff that they had when we first started was just things farmers made in their, you know, welding shop, and they still do that, and it works reasonably well. But one of the things we found, we've got things that are just more efficient and more. There's companies out there that have developed that make this stuff. We don't sell any product. We don't We're not marketing for anybody. We just know the ones that do good work, and we can put them in touch with the kind of people that will do a good job for them and be fair with them if they need something very significant. In some cases, it's a minor sort of thing that we can figure out other ways to help them with that. But and sometimes the farmers do it themselves. We just show them how to, you know, what it is they need to do. But one of the things we also are concerned about is that when they change something on the farm, they add a lift or whatever, that they're not enhancing, causing some other safety problem to be developed, like the stability of the tractor could be affected. And we have to look at that kind of those kind of issues as well.
Brenda, what about you? What's changed over the years in terms of what is available for as help for folks?
Well, I can speak only to my own situation here with prosthetic appliances. I know that in 1981, my prosthesis weighed a little over 13 pounds, and now it's like 6 or 5.5. And that makes a big difference on the wear and tear on the body itself. And, you know, everything advances as, you know, as 10 years go by, this is so much better. Another 10 years go by, this is so much better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think it's really not such a, I don't know how to say this, not such a, you know, black eye to have an injury. And
yeah, there's not so much of a stigma now, maybe, right?
Yes, a stigma is exactly the correct word.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, some of the companies have used, you know, the wheelchair basketball group as kind of a advertising thing. And then, God, in 1981, they had never done that.
Yeah. So it sounds like, a lot of things have changed. Well, I really appreciate you sharing your story with us. That's Brenda Bessie. She's in Erie. In Northern Illinois, where she farms, as she's been telling us. I want to thank Bob Aharon as well. Bob, we'll tweet out all the information about Illinois Agribility, but you all have a website. It's agribilityunlimited.org.
Right.
Is that the best resource for people who are looking for information?
Right, and call our toll-free number, 844-876-5623.
Thanks so much for being with me. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. 75 years ago, roughly 2 months after the attack on Pearl Harbor, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, which ultimately led to the forced relocation of more than 100,000 Americans of Japanese descent from their homes on the West Coast to internment camps, where they were held for up to 3 years. Rebecca Ozaki is the granddaughter of two of those people who were interned. She joins us now. She's in studio with me. She's been in Urbana for a talk on campus at the University of Illinois. She serves on the board of the Japanese American Citizens League, the Chicago chapter. They actually have an event coming up this Thursday. She's here now to share her grandparents' story and talk about how lessons from that era, how much she's thinking about that, especially in these days. Rebecca, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
You know, I think it's really rare for people in your grandparents' generation to speak about their experience in internment camps. But your grandfather, Sam Ozaki, was very outspoken about his experience. He passed away in 2015, but I know that he was very public about talking about that. Do you know? I wonder if you talked to him about why he felt like it was really important, because it is very unusual for Japanese Americans to be very outspoken about what happened.
Yeah, so I did grow up talking to him about it a lot, which is very rare for that generation. There's a lot of shame, I think, around what happened, even though there's nothing, you know, for that community.
For them to be ashamed of,
exactly,
sure.
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. He didn't start speaking about incarceration until, you know, after he relocated to Chicago, and I think became more involved in the education field. So he was the first Asian American principal in Chicago, and did become a very, you know, a huge community activist, very beloved in the Chicago community. And I think it did have a lot to do with him. It did have a lot to do with him being involved in the education community. I think he saw a lack of knowledge and education about what happened to Japanese Americans during World War II, and you know, he needed to fill that gap because no one or very few people were actually sharing their stories and talking about it.
So we actually have a clip of your grandfather speaking. This is actually from the Center for Arkansas History and Culture, and he's explaining what he remembers about the conditions at the Jerome Relocation Center in Arkansas. Let's hear that.
There were a few families there before us, but arriving there by train and then getting off, and you just see a lot of unfinished barracks, mud all over the place, and people finally showed us where we were to go and finally settled in there. But it was just a totally different kind of setting from sunny Southern California. And I remember saying that the total disappointment, all the years we have attended school, we had learned about this great democracy, this great constitution, and it was such a disappointment that it really did not exist. As former Chief Justice Evan Hughes says, the Constitution is just a piece of paper, and that's all it really was. Although if you have a vigilant community, citizenry, well-informed, then, of course, that Constitution can be a living instrument. But at that time, it was just a piece of paper to me.
That's Sam Saburo Ozaki, grandfather of Rebecca Ozaki, who's in studio with me, talking about his experience being incarcerated in a relocation camp as a Japanese American during World War II. And Rebecca, that's really powerful, everything that he says there. I mean, there's so much in there that I kind of want to talk to you about, but I guess I just want to start with your grandfather's story. So he was in his family, they were in LA before they were moved.
Yeah, so they lived in LA. They actually owned a farm not too far outside of LA. And he was 17 years old when Pearl Harbor was bombed by Japan. I remember him telling me about, you know, hearing it on the radio and running into their home and telling his siblings and his parents that this happened. And I think at the time he didn't know what would happen to them, but he knew something was going to happen just because he looked, you know, they were Japanese, even though he was born and raised in the United States.
And how many, so he went with his family, he went with his parents and siblings?
Yeah.
And were they sent, they were in two different camps?
Yeah. So the family initially was just completely split up. He used to tell me about, I think a few weeks or a few months after the executive order came out, some FBI agents came to their house and took away his father. They didn't really know why, other than maybe he was a community leader at the time. But they did not know where they took him. And I think they weren't reunited until maybe a year later. So initially, his father was taken away. The siblings were together, but his brother, I believe, went to go volunteer to help build one of the camps, actually. So everyone was just pretty split up from the time the war started. And even to 75 years later, I think their family was pretty split up. And they didn't, he used to express they didn't really know each other after that.
Wow.
Yeah.
One of his, one of your grandfather's siblings went to go build a camp?
Yeah, he, you know, I don't really know the details, but he did go and help get everything ready for the rest of the community. And I think it was more because, you know, he wanted to see what the conditions were and how he could help make it better. I think that's what, yeah, what happened with his brother.
So growing up as a kid, how would your grandfather tell you about these stories?
So we would go to a lot of community events. I remember specific moments when he would, you know, he would always stand up and say something. People would want him to say something. Specifically, I think the moment that I became politicized was when it was shortly after 9/11. He stood up in a room and was telling everyone we need to, you know, show up for the Muslim American and Sikh American communities at this time. That we can't let this happen again. That's something we always say, never let it happen again. And I just remember, I was pretty quiet as a kid, but I always remember him standing up and speaking in the room. Sometimes at his, you know, I would visit, they didn't live too far from us. We would just sit and I would ask him questions about it, especially as I got older, like in high school and college. I would just ask him random things about incarceration and he would always, you know, take the time to explain things to
like,
me.
What kind of questions would you ask your grandfather?
I think it was things like, you know, what were the conditions like? What happened? What happened to your dad? Why? I think the biggest question that I had for him was, why did they go to camp in the first place? And, you know, why didn't
they? Why did they resist?
Yeah, why didn't they resist? Especially our generation now, it's just, I couldn't understand why people wouldn't resist at the time. So that was one thing. The other thing I didn't understand was why he would enlist to go into the 442, which was the all Japanese infantry, when his family was locked behind barbed wire fence. Why was he so adamant about joining the war effort against Japan?
And why did he say that? Because your grandfather did enlist, and he was, mm-hmm. and in fact faced a lot of discrimination right. when he and this unit were first training to mm-hmm. go fight in the war.
Yeah, So during the war, the U.S. government sent out a questionnaire and it asked, you know, would you fight for your country, which was a very weird concept when they were behind barbed wire fence. But he was really adamant about going. A few things he said to me were, one, because he thought that if he enlisted, they would bring his father back to them, that they would see that he was a loyal American and that... you know, his family would be reunited is the first thing. And the second, which is what a lot of people that joined the 442 say, is to prove their loyalty to their country. A lot of them were born and raised in the U.S. They didn't know anything about Japan. So this was their way of doing that.
Was your grandfather born in the U.S.?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So this is the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. It was an all Japanese American Army unit. So that was sort of the beginning of why he did it. What mm-hmm. was his time like in the military?
He did talk about discrimination. I think they went, I don't know if they went to Hawaii or if they trained with a lot of the Hawaiian soldiers who were also Japanese American. But those soldiers were not in incarceration camps. So there was just some communication issues about, you know, who each other were, I think. And I know that. You know, people say that the 442 is the most decorated unit in American history. But I think if you really look at it, they're the most decorated because they have the most Purple Hearts. So that means they were the most, you know, they were the most injured, aside from acts of valor as well. But they were the ones who were sent into the, I guess, to the situations and the battles that other people... Or I guess other soldiers weren't sent to.
It sounds like really dangerous.
Yeah, like the most dangerous.
The riskiest operation.
Exactly.
Your grandfather had a Purple Heart.
Mm-hmm.
How did he feel about being a veteran? I wonder if he talked to you about what that was like to be a veteran, an American veteran with a Purple Heart, who also had a history of being incarcerated by right. the American government for his, you know, for his nationality. Or his, not even his nationality, his family's nationality.
Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't talk about being in the 442 that much. He said specific things to me about it, but I do know he lost a lot of friends during that time. And I think there's just a lot of trauma associated with that for him. There is a Nisei 442 organization that he told me tried to get him to join them, you know, once he moved to Chicago many times, but he didn't want to. I didn't push that question, though, with him that much, I think, because of the trauma that was associated with it.
Now, your grandmother was 14 mm-hmm. when she was interned.
Yeah.
Did she talk about her experience very much?
She rarely spoke to me about her experience. I remember specific things and specific moments she told me about, like standing next to the fence and the guards pointing guns directly inwards at her, even though she was only 14 years old at the time. Her father got sick in the camps, and she told me that, or you know what, I don't even think she told me this, but my dad told me this. Her father, even after the camps closed, remained in the camps because he was too sick to leave. She was really close to her dad, and he actually passed away in the camps. So I think that has a lot to do with why she didn't want to talk about things as well. So aside from the shame of why that generation didn't want to talk about it, there is a lot of trauma associated.
Can you explain a little about, for people who aren't familiar, sort of this concept of the shame and why you think people didn't want to talk about it? Because I think it might make sense to some people, but it might be confusing to others. Mm-hmm. I think especially generations, people our age, it might be more confusing.
Right. So there's a saying that they used to say a lot in the Japanese American community called gaman. And gaman means to persevere, through, you know, intolerable situations. And that's something that was constantly repeated in the community, that they will persevere, which of course they did. But beyond that, I think there's also an association that they didn't want to talk about their experience because they didn't want to be seen as different, right? So after the war, I think a lot of Japanese Americans tried, and during the war as well, tried to be as American as possible, whatever they meant, whatever that meant to them at the time, whether it was, you know, they were forced to burn everything they had that was Japanese, you know, associated with the country. A lot of people, even though they knew Japanese growing up, stopped speaking Japanese completely and didn't want to teach their kids that. So I know zero Japanese. There was just this huge rift that was caused and a lot of compensation, or overcompensation, I think, in our community to become like the ideal Americans. And people didn't want to speak about their experience. I think they didn't want to draw attention to the differences.
I'm speaking to Rebecca Ozaki. She's a Chicagoan. She's on the board of the Japanese American Citizens League, the Chicago chapter. We've been talking about her grandfather, Sam, who was Chicago's first Asian American principal. He was in the CPS system for more than 30 years working. How much of you think your grandfather's ability to speak out is about the whole notion of education and educating this generation and subsequent generations about the history of Executive Order 9066?
I think it has everything to do with education, and a lot of the work that the Japanese American Citizens League does now is around education about the incarceration experience, from the language that was used by the government and the executive order to going into schools to educate about people's personal experiences during incarceration. And it's unfortunate now because so many of that generation has already passed away. So it's up to, you know, my generation and the one before me to continue their stories. So that's something we're continuously trying to do.
And is that something your parents passed on to you? Is it something you sort of, you said there was a moment that you became politicized. Mm-hmm. What was that like?
Yeah, I was very, very, very close to both of my grandparents. So I spent a lot of time with them. The generation above me, which is the Sansei and my parents' generation, I think that they, even more than me, didn't understand why their parents didn't resist. For a long time, their parents didn't talk to them about incarceration. It was just completely dead silence around that issue. So it was a struggle, I know, for my dad to understand for a long time. And him and maybe his siblings as well were very angry about it. Angry at the government, angry probably with their parents for supposedly not doing anything about being incarcerated, or not resisting at the time. And especially because that was during the time when the civil rights movement was starting, a lot of things were happening with resistance in this country. And that's his generation. And I think my generation, the Yonsei fourth generation, is now trying to bridge that gap and figure out what we now can do together.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Rebecca Ozaki, with a Chicagoan. She's on the board of the Japanese American Citizens League. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. We'll be right back. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. My guest is Rebecca Ozaki. She's a Chicagoan. She's in studio with me in Urbana because she's been speaking on campus here to Asian American students at the University of Illinois. That's why she stopped by our Urbana studios. She's on the board of the Japanese American Citizens League. They've actually got an event on Thursday. We've been talking about the story of her generation, as well as her grandfather and her grandmother, who were incarcerated 75 years ago. That's Executive Order 9066, signed by President Roosevelt. More than 100,000 people, 100,000 Americans of Japanese descent who were in those camps. And we're talking about that today. Rebecca, I mean, everything you shared, it sounds so hard to hear, like mm-hmm. everything that happened. Do you feel like we have lost this story in America in understanding of what happened to Japanese Americans? It was 75 years ago. I'm just thinking of even recently an op-ed that was in a Washington newspaper just a few weeks ago talking about this as if it was a good thing that we put mm-hmm. Japanese Americans in camps. This was 3 weeks ago in a newspaper, an op-ed in Washington State. I mean, I wonder if you think we know enough about what happened.
I do not think we know enough about what happened. Like I mentioned, the Japanese American Citizens League, they do focus on education. I think right now it is hitting us that there are too many parallels to what is happening today. You know, the timeline of what's happening even just really parallels what happens over 75 years ago. I think we tried to, you know, back then the community tried to have the United States set a precedent through redress, actually, which is the Civil Liberties Act of 1988, where the U.S. government issued a formal apology to the Japanese American community and gave monetary compensation. But it's not that they wanted monetary compensation or only the formal apology, but it's that the Japanese American community organized so that the U.S. government would be held accountable for what happened to their community 75 years ago. And we thought that that would play a huge role in saying that you can't just do this. You have to, you know, take that accountability and responsibility and understand what you did to our community and that it can't happen again. So to me, it's just baffling that this is happening, you know, as we're sitting here right now, and that other communities of color, a lot of communities in the United States, are being specifically targeted by the government all over again. There's so much education that still needs to be done, and not just about incarceration, but about other communities of color right now and how all of our communities can communicate together.
And when you say that, I think there are people who are listening who will say President Trump's travel ban did not mention Muslims. It was not targeting Americans. What's your response to that?
I think in these executive orders, like I mentioned before, there's very specific language used to avoid saying the Muslim community, or very specific language. Actually, I went to a talk at the Asian American Cultural Center, and someone was explaining the language used in these current executive orders. And there was specific language saying that we need to uphold America's values and things that have a lot to do with assumed ideologies about different communities. I definitely believe that the government uses specific language to avoid targeting in their policies right now, just as they did with the Executive Order 9066 75 years ago.
So the Executive Order 9066, mm-hmm. can you tell us about that? Did it not mention Japanese Americans specifically by name?
It did. It did say, you know, Japanese or those of Japanese ancestry, but it also used language such as aliens and non-aliens have to report to these relocation centers. And if you think about that, what is a non-alien? That was their way of avoiding saying citizens of the United States. And there's specific instances of different euphemisms used in that language, or euphemisms and that language used in that executive order. And I think the same thing is happening with what the current administration is doing right now.
And that said, what's your message? You're on campus speaking with college students, to Asian American students at the Asian American Cultural Center at the University of Illinois. What's your message to students today? You're a recent college graduate yourself, UIUC, I should mention, in between a college and graduate school. What do you think the message is for not just Asian Americans of your generation, college students, but for I'm all college students, because the, you know, there's lots of folks who are who attend these events.
Right. The obvious message is that we need to stand up to injustices that are happening today. That 75 years ago, the Japanese American community didn't have that many allies standing next to us and showing up for us, saying that this, we can't let this happen. Today, the only silver lining really I see is that there are people willing to resist things that are happening that they believe, you know, are unjust or unconstitutional. Specifically, I think I've been through this year of me trying to figure out what I need to do for our communities, not just the Japanese American community, but marginalized and communities of color. So to all college students, because I went through it a few years ago as well, I think we need to find out specifically what our own strengths are and how we can contribute to, like, to this movement that has a lot of momentum right now, whether that's by just having conversations with your family and friends about what's actually happening, because a lot of people never have these conversations. Having conversations with people who, yeah, just don't have the space to do that is the number one thing I think that you or we as college students can do. And then it's also just figuring out how to stay sustained in this movement as well and not to burn out, because that's something I see happening a lot. It's very demoralizing what we're seeing now, especially because this happened 75 years ago. So I think taking care of yourself is another way. You don't have to show up for every single rally, but figure out what you can do and how you can sustain yourself right now.
Rebecca, you're youth co-chair of the Japanese American Citizens League. They're a national organization. What kind of work are you involved in with that group?
So I'm on the Japanese American Citizens League Chicago chapter. I've been on the board for 2 years in this position. There's a few things that we've been trying to do. One of them, 2 years ago, we started a group within the JACL called Next Generation Nikkei. And that group is specifically for young professionals. Youth is a loose term in the Japanese community because there's so many older generations and this huge split, and then a lot of us that feel a lot younger. So that is really just a mobilizing group in our organization to make sure that Japanese Americans still identify with their roots and get to know one another. Japanese Americans have the largest number of out marriages. So a lot of us, including myself, are mixed. And the identity gets kind of lost sometimes. Things don't get passed down the same way, and we are trying to sustain our identity. Another program, which is our largest program at JACL Chicago, is the Contra Project. And that is a completely now youth-run program. So the alumni of the program run it, including myself. And that is a program for Japanese Americans or those who identify as Japanese Americans. We send 10, 18 through 25-year-olds to Little Tokyo in L.A. and to Manzanar incarceration camp. And there they learn about, you know, this dark history and also what they can do specifically, like we talked about, to make sure it doesn't happen, or how do we resist now.
So do you actually send them to the internment camp so they see where and what it was like for people to be incarcerated there?
Right. We send.
Have you been?
Yeah, I've been. I went on the first year of this program 5 years ago. It was run by my my friend, Christine Montagno, who's the organizer in the Japanese community. I went 5 years ago. That was right after my grandmother passed away. She wasn't in Manzanar incarceration camp, but it was still a very powerful experience to see, you know, the desert and see how, and I guess wonder how people actually lived in these conditions. There was a gravesite there too, and I'll never forget standing there and seeing graves of children and the people that passed in Manzanar as well. And I actually went last year too, but this time as a program coordinator, and which was a different experience, but it was just as powerful.
I can't imagine that must have been really tough for you as well.
Yeah, it was very difficult to be there, and especially to be there with Japanese Americans who are my age, because, you know, when we think about it, we were talking about how this would have been us if we were born in that time. We would be in those camps as well, which is why it's really difficult to think about today and how, yeah, we could be in those camps again and we don't know what's going to happen anymore.
So for you, what does it mean? You said something about how you feel like Asian Americans, this is an opportunity for Asian Americans to be allies to other targeted or marginalized people. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
I think that not just Asian Americans, but all of us now have the opportunity to learn more about each other, to connect to other communities. I think it's very difficult when we try to organize sometimes to communicate with one another and even just understand each other. In the Asian American community, there's a lot of rhetoric around like anti-blackness, for example. There's a lot of just misunderstandings in our community, and I think among and between communities as well. So I think the first step really is just trying to learn more about each other and to start pushing ourselves out of our comfort zone to learn how we can help each other.
That said, as lots of people are talking about, Sunday was Remembrance Day this past Sunday. Mm-hmm. It's been 75 years since all of this happened. Just as we wrap this up, I just wonder what you think you want people to remember about that time.
There are a lot of things I think that we can learn from incarceration. Off the top of my head, the first is that we need to keep those who are in positions of power accountable for what they say and do. And there's many ways to do that. But these are the people who are supposed to be protecting us. And I think that's a big, it's a lesson to think about of these are the people we trust to protect us. These are the people we voted into office to protect us. So how do we keep them accountable? And that can be done through getting involved in local politics or through voting if you're eligible to vote, and having these conversations. That's definitely probably the first thing I would say. And especially today, I think, I wonder just how this is happening and how those in power can still, operate through fear, I think is what's happening. A lot of fear politics. And back then what happened is that the communities were fearful of Japanese Americans even before the bombing of Pearl Harbor happened. And that was fueled, by the same sentiments of saying that they were taking people's jobs, things that are happening or that people are saying today, a lot of economic talk as well. For example, in Hawaii, even though that's where Pearl Harbor happened, Japanese Americans were not incarcerated. Because the local economies depended on Japanese Americans. So I think we need to think about why this is happening again and, what is driving this in our government and in our communities.
Rebecca Ozaki is a Chicagoan. She's on the Chicago chapter of the Japanese American Citizens League, talking to us about the experiences of her grandparents 75 years ago. Thanks so much for being with us, Rebecca.
Thank you.
That's all the time we've got today. You can always find our past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. And we love feedback from you. All of those links, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us on social media, or message us there, it's all on our website, 21stshow.org. On Twitter, our handle is 21stshow. That's 21st show. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. And when we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest Illinois news. At our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. We're produced by Haula Delahi, Christine Herman, and Alan Montesilio. Abrar Alhiti is our intern. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help, and to the band Public Access for our theme music. And finally, last but not least, I want to say special thanks to producer Sean Newman. He's been with us since last summer and just wrapped up his time with us. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.